collaboration of one of the names. Now, these squares, anything that's in a rectangle, represents a movement that is still an active Hasidic movement to this day. So you start with the Baal Shem Tov. Okay, he's on the top. There are four primary disciples. However, the Hasidic movement almost totally originated from the students of the Maggid of Mezerich. So we have Pinchas of Karetz, they were great Hasidic masters, but the great dynasties come from Rav Dov Ber, the Maggid of Mezerich, and then we see his disciples. And do you see the Chozer of Lublin where he is? We have Rav Dov Ber, go down to Rav Elimelech of Lezench, and Rav Elimelech of Lezench had Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Horowitz, the Chozer of Lublin. Well, see separate chart. The Chozer of Lublin is the entire next page. Okay? Wow. So the Chozer of Lublin, by far, most Hasidic movements actually come from the Chozer of Lublin. Okay? Do you see how to read these two things together? So for example, there are two Hasidic movements that were directly established by the disciples of the Maggid of Mezerich, and that is Lubavitch, Chabad, which is Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. And then you'll see Rav Aaron of Karlin. You see right next to it? Lithuania, 1736 to 1772. This started a Hasidic movement which is still functioning today. It's relatively small but very intense, called Karlin Stola, which was the two towns in Europe. They're situated in Yerushalayim and near Meir Shalim. And if you go there, they're still very known for their ecstatic prayer. Prayer is very ecstasy. Friday night, many people come to watch the Hasidic Rebbe conduct what's called the Tish, in which food is distributed. And they're very, very friendly. You walk in, they'll get you a seat, even to women. You walk in, they'll get you a seat, they'll offer you food. They're very, very welcoming. So on one hand, they're somewhat insular. They're not like Chabad, which goes all over the world, engaged in outreach. But if you find yourself within their confines, they're a very, very warm and a welcoming group. And that comes from Rav Aaron of Karlin. Now, one thing you may notice, if you look at the disciples of the Maggid of Mezerich, you will see that there are vastly different ages. For example, Rebbe Elimelech was born in 1717. Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev was born in 1740. So basically, Rebbe Elimelech is a much older disciple. And in fact, some of Rabbi Elimelech's disciples also studied under the Maggid of Mezerich, meaning this chart is misleading in the sense that people who are disciples of somebody actually spent some time with the teacher. You see in the little asterisk there that the Chozer of Lublin and the Maggid of Koznitz, who are listed as the disciples of Rabbi Elimelech, were also, in their younger years, they also were direct disciples of the Maggid of Mezerich. But this indicates their primary affiliation. So just looking at the squares, just for the rectangles, in terms of actual movements that exist today, there's the Lubavitch movement, which is the most well-known of the Hasidic movements. Its technical term is Chabad. Chabad is an abbreviation. Chachma Bina Datz, wisdom, understanding, knowledge. Rav Shneur Zalman was the most philosophical-minded of all of the Maggid's Talmidim, and even to this day, Lubavitch is really the only Hasidut which has formal instruction in Hasidic philosophy. If you go to Gera or the like, there's not a formal curriculum of Hasidic philosophy. Lubavitch does do that in their institutions, and that is the legacy of Rav Shneur Zalman, who's also one of the great prolific writers. Rav Shneur Zalman's friends, these were his personal buddies, were Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev and Rav Aaron of Karlin. Now, we did spend time talking about Rav Levi Yitzchak, so you're familiar with him. Let me just tell you one thing that Rav Shneur Zalman said about Rav Aaron of Karlin, describing his colleague, who was a bit older. He said Rav Aaron of Karlin had such yirat shamayim, such fear of heaven, that he described it, how would a person feel if they were tied to a tree and an arrow, somebody was aiming a bow and arrow at them, and the bow had already been released, and the arrow was speeding towards their hearts. What type of fear would they feel at that given split second? He says, that is Rav Aaron of Karlin's Yirat Shamayim, he said, as it pertains to small matters. As it pertains to significant matters, Roshner Zalman said, there's nothing he could say about it at all. That's how he described Rav Aaron of Kalin. There is a famous story about Rav Aaron of Kalin that is often used, maybe even heard on Rosh Hashanah. That, you know, the service on Rosh Hashanah begins with the recitation of HaMelech, God is the King. Now that's one of the Chazan typically gets up there. And Rav Aaron of Kalin, one of Rosh Hashanah, fainted as the Chazan began to say HaMelech. Or maybe he was the Chazan and he fainted. And when they revived him, they asked him, what were you thinking of? So he said, I was thinking of a passage in the Talmud. We study this passage on the 9th of Av, that when the temple was about to be destroyed, if you remember, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, one of the great rabbis, managed to escape from Jerusalem and go to the emperor, go to Vespasian. Vespasian at the time was a general. And he says to Vespasian, Shalom alecha malka, the Aramaic, welcome king. And Vespasian said, you deserve to die. Because number one, I'm not a king, I'm only a general. But then he said, and if I am a king, why didn't you come to me earlier? What took you so long? And this is the language of the Talmud. Imalka ana, if I am a king, why didn't you come earlier? So Rav Aaron Karlina said, I thought of that passage of the Talmud as we proclaim God as the king, that God might be asking each of us the question, if I am your king, why didn't you come before this? Why did you wait so long? He says, I thought about that. And I fainted. And that's Rav Aaron of Rav Aaron of the city of Karlin. And in fact, it's interesting that although Karliner Hasidim are not a large group, but they were at one time, in the early years of the movement, the single largest bloc. And in fact, the typical name in all of the anti-Hasidic activities, we talk about excommunication, they called the whole sect Karliners. All Hasidim were called Karliners. That was, in fact, even Rav Shneur Zalman was accused when he was arrested. His crime was he was a Karliner. He was a member of the Karliner sect, although he was not. So that's Rav Aaron of Karlin. So Lubavitch, which of course is worldwide, massive, known public relations geniuses, and we'll talk a little bit more specifically about their ideology, and Karlin Stolen are dynasties that were established by disciples of the Magid of Mezirich. Now we then look at Rabbi Elimelech of Lizensk, who was a great disciple of the Magid of Mezirich, and he had many students, but three primary ones. We talked about the Chozer of Lublin, and he was a very, very main establisher of Chassidut. He was the whole second chart. The whole second chart are the outgrowths of the Chozer of Lublin, and look how many rectangles are there. Dynasties that were established through the Chozer of Lublin. Then we have the Magid of Koznitz, who in many ways seems to be almost the sweetest of the Hasidic rebbes, and actually did not establish any lasting dynasties. But Rav Avraham Yehoshua Heschel, who we did not talk about, but I want to mention him a little bit, he was the Rav of Apt, or Apatel in Polish, and that Abraham Joshua Heschel is a descendant, or was a descendant, of this person. And he established a hereditary dynasty, which is around today, called Kopishnitz. So there's the Kopishnitzer Rebbe and the like. Again, these are small, and after the Holocaust, they're even smaller. But the Apter Rav was known as the lover of Israel. He was very similar to Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. And the Kopishnitzer dynasty was also very, very well known for the great love and compassion that they had for Jews of all types. So there is, to this very day, in Israel, a Kopishnitzer Rebbe, a small group of people. Then you see Vishnitz, these are Hungarian Hasidut and Kaliver. But if you turn to the next page, the Chozer of Lublin, I just want to show you some of this activity here. You'll see that on top there are different countries. There are two branches for Hungary. That one of the disciples of the Chozer of Lublin was Rav Moshe Teitelbaum. And he was the founder of a dynasty that is today known as Satmer. And then you'll notice another person, Tzvi Elimelech of Dinov. And that in turn generated two dynasties. Sometimes they broke off, Munkach and Blizov. Now, Satmar and Munkacs were the dominant Hasidut in Hungary. Are very, very similar. Their ideology is almost identical. Lizard is a little different. You have to understand that by the middle and end of the 19th century, we're no longer dealing with distinct philosophies in a mystical sense. And basically, Hasidut kind of moved away from a lot of Kabbalah at this time. However, they became very practical-oriented movement. They became institutions. They created yeshivot, they created seminaries, they created shuls, they created hospitals, they created organizations. So even today, if somebody were to ask, what is the difference in philosophy between a Ger Chassid and a Belzer Chassid? There is no reasonable answer that you can give to that. Because it's no longer the philosophy, it's the question of being affiliated with a certain teacher and with certain institutions. Now, Satmar and Munkacs were known as being very, very strong opponents to anything which they perceived as modernization in the world. So for example, we know that the reform movement first got started basically in Germany, which of course did not have any Hasidic movement, but Hungary was the second big place. So what was the reform movement in Hungary initially? Very minor changes, such as giving the drasha, giving the sermon in Hungarian instead of Yiddish. In fact, I'll tell you, to this day, I remember I used to give a class in Baltimore, the Baltimore Hasidic shul. And I was giving a class on Shabbat in English. And somebody pointed me to some sign on the wall going back 150 years ago that says, in the Beit HaKnesset, it is forbidden to speak any language except Hebrew and Yiddish. So going back to this time when they excommunicated the Reform movement. And he said, you know, this is still binding. So the compromise was I had to, since I'm not a fluent Yiddish speaker, I had to give the class in a back room. So the Hungarian tradition was that one does not concede to reform, even on so-called minor things, as giving the drasha in the vernacular. So they were very avid fighters against the reform movement. Of course, this very day, it is very well known that Satmar and Munkacs, and there's still Munkacs Hasidut as well. Munkacs is primarily in Israel. Satmar is much larger. In fact, Satmar numerically might be the largest Hasidut in the entire world. Numerically, because Lubavitch does much, much more outreach. Mm-hmm. But how many people are Lubavitch Hasidim as compared to Satmar? Satmar, there are many, many thousands of Satmar Hasidim. They are known as Munkacs as well as being virulently anti-Zionist. They regard the Zionist movement as, number one, being premature, because it is wrong to have a Jewish state until the coming of the Mashiach. Let me emphasize this. They were not necessarily averse to settling in the land of Israel. They acknowledge Israel as a holy land, but they felt it was improper to establish a Jewish government. They thought that until the Mashiach comes, we are supposed to leave it to God, and we're not allowed to end the Galut prematurely. In addition, of course, they are against the idea of a non-religious state. But even if it would be a religious state, they're against it. They're against the concept of a Medina. And in some circles, this was taken to the extremity, which offended and hurt many, many people, of actually joining up. In fact, one of the ministers at one point of the Palestinian government, before they were given any authority, was there was kind of a Satmar or a Turei Karta. Turei Karta is essentially, Turei Karta is a phrase that means guardians of the city. That's a small group of people in Jerusalem, really very, very small group that's affiliated with this philosophy that actually calls for the establishment of a Palestinian state. So politics makes strange bedfellows. Because the extreme right in religiosity actually has an affinity with some of the political agenda of the extreme left politically. Meaning to say, the most conservative religiosity joins up with calls for a Palestinian state. And one of them even became Minister of Information or Propaganda or whatever it was called. And I remember just last, was probably two or three quarters ago, very strange bedfellows, where when they were conducting negotiations about, concerning the Oslo Accords, the Satmar, who was affiliated with the PLO, came to hear Megillah and Kesher Israel along with the Israeli representatives, so they're meeting there in that religious context. So the truth of the matter is that the Sakhmer Rebbe, not the Rosh Teitelbaum, but the Yoel Teitelbaum, his grandson, was a very, very great scholar, and a very, very great man in many ways. His ideology was based on a number of passages. He wrote many books examining the ideology, trying to prove his arguments from Talmud and Midrash and the like. It was not simply, you know, an unthinking reaction that he had, but it was a carefully thought out program. But be as it may, the Sakhmer are known as being very anti-reform, anti-Zionist, this was their separatist in the sense that they believe that in order to preserve a tradition, there's a certain amount of insularity that needs to be gained. However, within the confines of the community, they've established a remarkable series of social service institutions. They've organized, for example, the single largest Sikur Cholim project in the city of New York. Visiting sick people in hospitals is organized by Sakhmer. And in fact, in those visits, they bring food and company and all sorts of things. They do not discriminate between Hasidic Jews and non-Hasidic Jews, or religious Jews and non-religious Jews. Their services are in fact available to anyone who could benefit. So it's kind of a double picture, where the ideology itself is very, very insular and rejects a lot of things, and yet there is also a great deal of personal generosity and kindness that are shown. And there are large movements. The birth rate is very, very big. Williamsburg in Brooklyn is their primary, or was their primary place, but now they have Kiryat Yoel, which are various towns upstate New York, and they are a very big presence in Jerusalem. They're a very big presence in Jerusalem. The Eidah Haredit, the so-called religious congregation, is largely under the domination of Sakhmer. And many, many people you know, follow their guidelines in halakha. Mm-hmm. Munkach and Sakhmer are really two peas in the pot. Basically, they both are distinguished for a very, very strong anti-Zionist position. In this connection, I should mention the very famous, we talked about it beforehand, the very, very famous work of a defector, really, from the Sakhmer philosophy. And this was a rabbi in Hungary who was Rabbi Sakhar Do Teichtel. Teichtel, the English spelling would be T-E-I-T-C-H-A-L. Teichtel. And he was a follower of the Rebbe of Munkach and the Rebbe of Sakhmer. Sakhmer, by the way, is a Hungarian term, Satumara, which means Saint Mary, interestingly enough. That was the town. The town of Sakhmer Chassidut was Saint Mary. They Judaized it to be Satmar. And Rav Teichtel subscribed to the entire philosophy. And when he was rounded up to Auschwitz towards the end of the war, as Hungarian Jews were killed, he began to rethink his position. And he came to the conclusion that, again, he ascribed the Holocaust to various faults that he saw in the Jewish people. Again, one could argue about that. He saw in the Jewish people hatred, polarization, division. And he also saw in the Jewish people a lack of appreciation for the gift of the land of Israel that God had made available to them. And in a very, very erudite and scholarly work that he wrote right in the middle of the war, shortly before his own death, he came to the conclusion that the attitude that rejected the Zionists because they were not religious or were not observant was contributing to hatred among Jews. And it was the hatred among Jews that was responsible for all that had befallen them. And he himself considered himself part of the people who were to blame for this, and he recanted, and he did what he called tshuva. And the book that he wrote has not been translated in English. It really should be, but it's very relevant to some issues today. It's Eim Habanim Smecha, which is a verse from Hallel that says, the mother of children shall rejoice. And it says in Hallel that the woman that is barren shall be given children, shall rejoice. And this is a description of the land of Israel rejoicing as its inhabitants come back. And Lehepech, he reversed his position, and he called for Jews to make Aliyah And of course, he calls the building of bridges between the religious and the secular. And he also talked about the fact that those who contribute to the building of the lands are doing holy work. And even if they don't have other mitzvot, this is their mitzvah by which they bring holiness into the world. This, of course, is the same philosophy that Rav Kook articulated. But the paradox is, he was the Hungarian Rav Kook. And the paradox is that he was raised in a milieu that had totally rejected those ideas. But he had come to it in the course of experiencing the persecutions of the Jews that he witnessed during World War II. Of course, the Satmar official position was exactly the opposite, that it was the Zionists that were responsible for the Holocaust. Again, I don't want to reopen a whole can of worms, but one could refer, for example, you know, Ben Hecht, the famous screenplay writer, Ben-Hur, wrote a work, Perfidy, which was published shortly after the war, in which he does indeed show how many Zionist leaders did frustrate various attempts to rescue the Jews. There was, in some segments, I can't say this was widespread, but there were in some segments of the Zionist movement a theory that by letting Jews die in Europe, we will establish a stronger case to be established with the State of Israel. And in terms of money and various other resources, there was a feeling that we need the money for the build up the land and not to save lives. And this has been documented, both in Ben Hecht's work and in the work of another Hungarian rabbi. He was not a chassid per se, but he was somewhat similar in philosophy to the Satmar. And that was Rav Michael Baer Weissmandel, who was a very extraordinary individual who managed to escape from concentration camps a number of times. He would jump off trains and things. And he was engaged in very top secret negotiations with Himmler towards the end of the war, where Himmler agreed to release Jews in exchange for trucks and money and bribes and the like. And Weissmandel was sending telegrams all over the world to try to get the funds, and he had a lot of trouble getting them. And he himself was very, very bitter against some Zionist leaders for this. So, again, I'm not here to address these difficult historical issues. Rabbi Michael Baer Weissmandel?
Yeah. I mean, he established yeshiva in
Nitra. After the war, he came to the United States. And he established a yeshiva in Mount Kisco, New York. It was called the Nitra Yeshiva. And all I'm saying is that things are very, very murky. On one hand, we have Rav Teichtal, who took the position that it was the Jewish rejection of working with the Zionists that signified sinat chinam, hatred and polarization, which caused all of these sorrows to happen. Then we have the Satmar, or Weissmandel's position was that it was the Zionist insistence upon land over life that was somehow responsible. So it's a very, very murky area, and the different ideologies here. Nevertheless, it can't be denied that there were certainly some excesses. And even Ben-Gurion was reputed to have said at one point that all land is liberated by blood. And to some degree, the blood of the Jews of Europe is how we will liberate our land. Again, in the Jewish calculus of value, however, we do believe that life is more important, even on the issue of territorial concessions.
Could you repeat what you said about Rabbi Weissmandel his Zionist?
Rabbi Weissmandel was a Hungarian rabbi, a young Hungarian rabbi, and remember that Hungary was not taken over by the Germans until very late in the war, 1944. And when, at that time already, through the Russian front, the Germans were really losing. And Rabbi Weissmandel entered into top-secret negotiations with Himmler, in which many of the Jews of Hungary could be freed from transport to Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen in exchange for trucks and money. Some of this would go to the German war effort, and some of this would go into Himmler's private pockets. A lot of it was just bribery. And Weissmandel was sending telegrams all over the world. Well, he got some response, but he didn't get enough.
America,
he didn't get enough.
Was he the one that put the end of the paper juice for sale?
Yes. Yes, Weissmandel was responsible behind it. Weissmandel had contacts, meaning there were some Americans that were involved that were helping him, Irving Goodman and the like. There were contacts that he had. But you have to understand, too, that the mainstream American organizations, such as the American Jewish Congress, and I don't want to go into a background here, But the mainstream American organization and the mainstream American rabbis, Stephen Weiss, who was called the Jewish Pope, Stephen Weiss was the most powerful and influential rabbi in America. And again, I assume that his motives were good. He was very, very against giving any direct aid to Germany because he felt that that would be unpatriotic and it might endanger the U.S. war effort. See, that was his calculation.
There was a lot of
anti-Semitism
in America.
And a lot of his fear of the accusation of dual loyalty. Well, here we have Jews sending money and sending things to Germany, which is at war with the United States. Stephen Weiss was against it. But, and of course, Stephen Weiss represented the mainstream Jewish establishment. But as a result, many Jews who could have been saved were not saved. And Weissmandl, later, after the war, wrote a book that in Hebrew is called Min HaMetzar, that means from the depths of distress I called out to God. And he writes, quoting the Bible, Madua karati v'ein onah, why do I call out? And there is no one that answers. And Ben Hecht wrote perfidy, etc. So a lot of this came out, a lot of this glossed over. It's a very, very...
Okay, you said something about Zionist land over life, and that's what he missed.
Ben Gurion once remarked that all land requires the sacrifice of blood, and the blood of the Jews in Europe will be how we will liberate our land.
And that's what happened.
But that is contrary to the Jewish calculus, where Judaism says life is more important than blood. Now, this is very relevant in considering the peace process as well. One can legitimately say that territorial concessions will endanger human life and therefore we shouldn't do them. But one cannot say that land is more important. Land overrides everything. Land does not override everything. Human life overrides everything. And then the question becomes, is giving up land a way of preserving life or is it a way of endangering life? One can make the argument, but one has to focus on what will maximize peace and security, not what will maximize territory. In a way, again, strange bedfellows, an extreme position that says land is more important than everything, which is sometimes stated as a halachic position, is exactly the great condemnation that Rebbe Weissmandl issued against some of the non-religious Zionists who were putting land above saving people.
I know this is so it's off the topic, continues to be off the topic, but what is the current justification for those in Israel who think that the assassination of Rabin justified?
Well, again, this is a whole other discussion. But they felt that Rabin's policies would have endangered the security of the population.
Would they give away the land?
Yeah. And therefore they felt, that he was endangering the lives of the entire country, and that needed to be removed as a matter of self-defense. I mean, that's what Radeif means. Radeif literally means that if somebody is trying to kill me, I can kill them. Like that's clear. I mean, that's not a made-up halakha. If someone has a gun at my heart, I'm allowed to kill them. They, or Yigal Amir at least, adopted the extreme position that Rabin's policies were equivalent to putting a gun at the heart of every single citizen of the state of Israel, therefore they took that extreme position. Again, in a democratic society, there are other ways of dealing with that than that vigilante. Now, that would be the theory that they thought.
These newspapers report the increasing number of Israelis who now go along with that position.
I didn't see that. Is that the...
No. Yeah.
What, they support the assassination? I don't...
Increasing numbers of Israelis will say that it was justified.
Is that true?
Yes.
I'm very surprised. I'm not sure what the point of...
There was a study.
I don't think beating a dead horse. I don't know what the point is of talking about the assassination after it occurred. I hope there's no call for a new, this is a new way of dealing with the political reality, which would be very, very unfortunate. But the issue, it does raise a difficult issue, which has its parallel in World War II, and that is it ever possible for a duly elected government to be guilty of treason against their nation. This actually was an issue that, under international law, arose under World War II in terms of the Vichy governments. Some of them were tried. Some of them were war heroes in World War I, and they were tried for treason, for collaboration. Now, without getting into assassination, is it possible indeed for someone to be guilty of treason? If I'm the president or the prime minister of a country, and a later government finds my actions to be self-destructive to the country, that's a scary thought. Somebody who's president could then be tried for treason because of giving aid and comfort to the enemy. But conceptually, that is some of the international law issues that forbid assassination raises. Those who were so opposed to his positions took the position that he was endangering the state. Therefore, just as the Vichy regime could be held guilty of collaboration, they felt Levin was a collaborator with an enemy. Again, that still wouldn't justify assassination. Then try it, you know, but that's the direction that they were going. So Sattler and Woodcotch, I'm sorry, I just want to go back to, I'm sorry,
or impeachment.
Or impeachment, yeah. Yeah, in a democratic society, there's really no reason to resort to assassination. So Sattler and Woodcotch are very, very similar in terms of their rejection of a Jewish state. Again, I want to emphasize, it is not predicated on the fact that the state is secular. Even if it would be a religious state, it would be prohibited until the Mashiach comes. Dluzak is another Hungarian dynasty, which is very apolitical. There was a great man, the Blizhever Rebbe, who just died a few years ago. He was almost 100 years old. And you may recall him, you may know him more than you think. Has anyone here ever seen the book Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
By Yaffa Alaya.
Yes, she's going to be a speaker here.
Okay. If you read her stories, virtually all of her stories involve the Rebbe of Lodz.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Rebbe's wife, the Rebbe's second wife, Dina Spiro, was also a person by many of the stories. So the Blizhever Rebbe was in Auschwitz. And there are many, many stories about how he tried to help people, keep them alive. And he would constantly talk about the Holocaust and remind people of what it was and the importance of keeping your faith in adversity. So he was not involved in political issues per se. He was not involved in, he was Zionism or anti-Zionism or these types of agitation issues. But he was a very, very great spiritual force in terms of giving people encouragement to remain strong in their faith even under the darkest conditions. So if you go back to the Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust, you will see innumerable stories involving his experience in the Holocaust. He lost a wife and many children. Then he remarried and had a second wife. And he adopted many orphans and he raised them and he made their wedding, their bar mitzvahs and their weddings and everything else. So that's Bluza. Also, it's kind of a cousin of Munkach, but a different, a little bit of a different orientation.
I think it's pronounced
Bluza. Bluza, well, the Z age is Bluza.
I'm Hungarian. Bluza, check with the
Balkans. Again, Bluza is not a major dynasty in size, but you have to understand the way this works. A person who has a Hasidic orientation will visit many rebbes. Now, you're not necessarily a chassid of one rebbe. So many people will visit the Blizhever Rebbe for a bracha, the Lubavitcher Rebbe for a bracha, the Gerer Rebbe for a bracha. So you have a core group who are Gerer Chassidim and Lubavitcher Chassidim and Babavir Chassidim and the like. But then you have people who kind of are generic hangers on. They go a little bit to everybody. And Blizhever is not at all a large group, but the Blizhever Rebbe was a very esteemed man. Of course, his son is now his successor, and they have a show, the Beit Medrash, and people daven there, and there's a fish Friday night and the like. Okay, so those are the movements in Hungary. Again, they come from the Chozer of Lublin that we talked about, the Seer of Lublin.
Where are they now?
Okay, well, Sattner, as I say, is Williamsburg, and in some things near Muncie, Kiryat Yoel. Near Muncie, Kiryat Yoel. In fact, there was a famous Supreme Court case just last year.
Yeah.
They established their own town, and as a result, they were eligible for public funding of their private schools because they were a municipality, and that got struck down, the separation of church and state, and now they're trying something else. Murkach is primarily also in New York and in Israel. And Beluzhov is basically in New York. It's basically in Borough Park. There's a small community in Borough Park. Okay. Hungary, of course, is their place of origin. Now, Galicia, there is no country Galicia anymore, but Galicia was the province of southeastern Poland on the Polish-Hungarian border. And here, there's a personality we did not talk about. I just want to mention some of these that we didn't talk about extensively. Rav Shalom Rokeach founded a dynasty that became known as Belz. Belz is, again, a little village in Poland. And Belz is still a very, very significant movement. Belzer Hasidim have many yeshivot, a number of synagogues, a number of other charitable institutions. Again, there are two places, well, they have three places, really. They have a big presence in Borough Park, New York. They have a larger presence in Israel. They are a very potent force in Israel. And Belz is a large Hasidut in Europe to this very day. If you go to Antwerp, there are certain centers in Europe. I mean, Poland obviously does not have any Hasidim anymore. But if you go to Belgium and Holland, Netherlands, you will see large groups of Belzer Hasidim on the mainland of Europe to this very day. Belz was always a very politically active Hasidut. In Poland, they were involved in the Polish parliaments. They were involved, in fact, they're involved in Israeli politics to this day. They're a powerful force. One thing that's very interesting to hear about the first Belzer Rebbe, that, again, this was remarked as very unusual. He used to eat breakfast with his wife, just to show you how the culture was very different. And that was very unusual because with Hasidic Rebbes, there was a strong separation between husbands and wives. They would not eat at the same table, at least when there were guests around. In fact, this was never the Lithuanian tradition. In Lithuania, families ate together. So the story goes, when Rav Meir Shapiro, who was the last Rav of Lublin before the war, Meir Shapiro, went to visit the Chafetz Chaim in Lithuania, he just made a request of the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim invited him for Shabbat. And Rav Meir Shapiro simply requested, could you have the women eat in another room? Because in Poland, we're accustomed to the men's table and the women's table. Chafetz Chaim said, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to withdraw the invitation. My wife, you know, eats with me on the table. Yeah. So there were different customs there. But the Belzer Rebbe used to eat with his wife. And the Hasidim used to remark that this is like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden before the invitation. And since they're so pure, there are no improper thoughts that they have, and therefore they can sit together. We cannot, because we're just mortals and we're prone to have improper thoughts, but the Rebbe could sit with his wife like Adam and Chava before the Garden of Eden. So that is Belz. Now, the next one is, these are people we didn't talk about, I just want you to know they are. You see Rabbi Yecheskel of Kuzmir, and he founded a dynasty that is known as Mudgets. Mudgets has one outstanding thing for which it is famous, and they were known for their music, for their tunes. The Mudgetzer Rebbe, who died in the Holocaust, this is much later, of course, it is said composed a new nigun, a new tune, every single day, as a way of praising God. And they have long symphonic arrangements. You can get, actually, tapes and records of Mudgetzer music. But all the Hasidic movements look to Mudgetz as kind of the musical inspiration of the movement. And these are very long, yearning songs, expressing the soul, desire to become attached to God. And there are many, many legends about various nigunim, that sometimes these nigunim were originally sung by shepherds, non-Jewish shepherds. And when the Rebbe heard the song, the Rebbe saw this was a song from the Beit HaMikdash that had somehow went into Galutz. And when the Rebbe learns the song, he is recapturing it and bringing it back to its source. And the way the story always ends is, as soon as the Rebbe learns the tune, the shepherd forgets it. Because he was just there to be the temporary repository until the Rebbe can liberate the song. And again, these are songs, you know, a nigun could last for 45 minutes, a single musical composition. And of course, there's very interesting studies, if any of you are musicologists, about the fact that much Hasidic music is connected very much to the folk music of that particular region. So the Hungarian Hasidut is one type of music, the Carpathian Mountains, a different type, Polish, a different type, Russian, a different type. For example, Lubavitch music, Lubavitch was primarily a Russian Hasidut, is very influenced by the Russian folk music, as opposed to the Hungarian, right? So there are different types of this. But Medrash was considered to be the great musical composers of Hasidut. Okay, now the next line we traced very extensively. Remember, that's the school of Peshitta. Mm-hmm. So look how that works. The Yehudi HaKadosh, the Holy Yid, Rab Simcha Bunim, the Kutzker Rebbe, and then you see that long line. That's the Ishbitz breakaway. I hope this is familiar. We talked about this. That's the Ravzina. That's one branch. And then we have Gir. Now Gir became the single largest movement in Poland. By World War I, one-third of Polish Jews were Hasidim, one-third were Hasidim, and of that one-third, more than one-half were the Hasidim of Ger. Ger, to this day, is the largest Hasidut in Israel. It's very, very politically powerful as well. And Ger's great emphasis was on learning. They were very learned people. They learn traditional, Torah, Gemara, those things. They do not have organized classes in Hasidic philosophy. That's not their thing. Their thing is to live a Hasidic life and study the traditional Torah that any yeshiva you would learn, Talmud, codes, and the like. And that is the Gir. Now you'll see, though, that from the Kutzker, although one might have thought the whole Hasidic movement might have been destroyed by the Kutzker Rebbe. I mean, he was so rejecting of so many things. But you see that from Kutsk, four distinct dynasties emerged. There is Ger, which is the biggest. Then there is the Ishbitzer Revolt. Remember, that's when the Kutsker Rebbe had the famous incident Friday night. That's the Ishbitz Revolt. But then there are two smaller dynasties. There is Rav Yitzchak Kalish of Varki. Now you'll notice that he was actually older than the Kutzker Rebbe, and yet he was treated as his disciple. The Kutzker Rebbe was born 1787. Rav Yitzchak Kalish was born 1779, and yet he was actually a disciple. And then you have Rav Chanuch of Alexandria. Alexandria is a city in Poland. Alexander Hasidim. Now, from Rav Yitzchak Kalish of Varki, we have a dynasty called Amshinov. Amshinov is a tiny little group of people. They're mainly focused in Yerushalayim. There's the Amshinov dynasty. Amshinov is known also for the very ecstatic prayers. For example, if you go to the Amshinov Beit HaMidrash Saturday night, they will continue with Sudash and Shit for about 3 or 4 hours after Shabbat. They just keep on going. Now, Alexander Hasidut was actually very, very large before World War II, before the Holocaust. The three main groups of Hasidut in Poland, Ger was the largest, Belz was the second, Belz was in Galicia, and Alexander was the third. In fact, it was said that Alexander was the Hasidut for the common man, because Ger attracted the scholars. Although I guess in Poland more people thought they were scholars, because Ger was the largest Hasidut. Alexander was said to be more of a common man Hasidut. But nevertheless, they both are from Rav Simcha Bunim, from the Yehudi HaKadosh. They are of the school of Peshitta. So from the Kutzker Rebbe, we have the Alexander, Amshinov, Ger, Ishbitz, and Radzina. Finally, if you look at yet another school, there is Rav Naftali of Rutgers, which we did not discuss, but his disciple was a very famous Hasidic Rebbe, Rav Chaim Halberstam of Sanz. He's called the Sanzer Rebbe, and from him comes two major dynasties which still function today, Bavlut, you've heard of the Bavlut Rebbe, and the Kleisenberger Rebbe. They are both, in fact you often see it, there's Sanz Bavlut and Sanz Kleisenberg, but they both come from the Sanzer Rebbe. Babov is mainly located in Borough Park, and Kleisenberg is located both in America and in Israel. Kreisenberger Rebbe was a, the last one who died very recently, was a survivor of the Holocaust. He lost 11 children in the Holocaust. He reestablished himself here and in Israel, and in fact, he built an entire community right outside of Netanya, and he established one of the best hospitals in Israel, Laniado Hospital, which is a very, very well-known, very well-regarded hospital, to follow halakha completely, together with the greatest advances in medical technology. He also created a very, very intensive learning program. This is a something that only the biggest scholars really do, but it's a situation where people learn 30 pages of Talmud a month, and they take an examination on it. And that determines the size of their stipend, how well they do. Where they get a certain stipend based on it. And that's a not only is that a very fast pace, but it requires a lot of mastery. And this was his plan, to create a cadre of people who would be the scholars and leaders of the Jewish people. And there are really thousands of, hundreds of people at least, who are enrolled in this program. Recently, they watered it down somewhat. I mean, there is that, that's the grade A way of doing it. I think they cut it down to 15 pages. They made the exam a little easier without some of the commentaries for people to who can join up who are not able to stay at that high pace. Now, learning 30 pages is not that difficult, but to be tested on it would be very difficult because it's a lot of material, and I would be afraid, somewhat afraid to make a test of that myself. So it's a very, very high high standard. So that's Bevod and Kreisenberg. So these are functioning Hasidic groups as well. So but once again, if you were to ask, you know, is Bevod different than Bells, and is Bells different than Mudgetts, etc., the differences are very, very small. Satmar and Munkach are indeed distinct. They are distinct because they have not so much a overall philosophy that's different, but they do have very specific issues over which they agitate. They believe in the state of Israel, for example, although they believe in Israel as a country. However, the other movements basically share a lot of common features. Ger, of all the movements, is probably the most emphatic on the study of Torah, but then we see that Kreisenberger Rebbe was the one who instituted the intensive Talmud classes. So, at this point, you have to understand, we're not dealing so much with philosophical distinctions. We are basically dealing with institutions that take on a life of their own, and many people are floaters. Many people go to this Rebbe and that Rebbe and that Rebbe to absorb a little bit from both. Some Rebbes, some movements, will emphasize love of Israel more than others. Some will emphasize intensive study of Torah more than others. Some movements pray long and slow and intensively. And others believe it's better to pray fast because your mind doesn't get distracted so much. Right? So there are different nuances that way. Sometimes some of the movements have the Rebbe that has a long tish Friday nights. And some only have occasion. Right? So there are different nuances here. But it's very, very hard to trace these to any type of philosophical orientation that they view the world differently. They essentially have a common value system.
Now the Satmar and the Munkach Hasidim were strong rejections of modernity and reform and Zionism.
Yes.
But the weight of all these other groups, did they have an attitude towards these?
Yes, virtually all Hasidic groups were very anti-modernist. They were very much against modernization. And you know, they are a conservative small c, a conservative force, they're conservative great, yeah. But the question becomes, did they actively, you know, campaign against things, or they just kind of keep their own counsel? Some were less open than others. Now,
what happened to Alexander?
Alexander was almost totally, remember, they were the third largest Hasidic movement in Poland. They were almost totally decimated in the Holocaust. And there is Alexander Rebbe, Alexander Hebel. There are a little,
where?
I think there's one in Bar Park and one in Tel Aviv. These are small institutions. Babov, on the other hand, Babov is very, very successful. You go to Bar Park, you see a very, very large yeshiva and a very large shul, etc. So I won't say it's the luck of the draw, but again, certain movements were able to establish and those certain not. Now, this is all the Chosea of Lublin, right? All of this comes from one disciple of Rabbi Elimelech, who was one disciple of the Maggid of Mezrich, most of the Hasidic movements. Now, Lubavitch is a totally different thing. Lubavitch comes directly from Rav Shneur Zalman, who is a disciple of the Maggid, and Lubavitch is a very, very distinct Hasidic movement. Lubavitch is not the same. First of all, they don't even wear the same hats. All Hasidic movements wear fur hats. Lubavitch wears felt hats, right? So that's one difference. They wear a different hat. And Lubavitch is the movement, above all, that is committed to aggressive outreach. Lubavitch has some other ideas as well. Lubavitch has some very interesting inconsistencies in its present political positions. It's very interesting. On one hand, they're totally committed to outreach, to bring Judaism to every Jew. Right? There'll be a Lubavitch in Hong Kong, Timbuktu, Nepal. Absolutely, Bangkok, anywhere, everywhere. So every Jew counts, every Jew needs to be connected to, etc. Right? So that's their motif. On the other hand, you do know that on the Who's the Jew controversy, whether the law should be amended to say that only Orthodox conversions are recognized. We know that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Blessed Memory, was the absolutely strongest person who demanded that the law be amended to delegitimize legally conservative Reform conversions, right? He was the one strongest. He was also very outspoken against territorial concessions. Really, it's unique. Most Hasidic and non-Hasidic rabbis acknowledge the halakhic possibility of giving up land for peace. Whether it's wise or not is another question, but they do not say halakhically it's forbidden. Lubavitcher Rebbe was the sole authority who said it is absolutely prohibited. Which is a funny thing, because Lubavitch in the 1920s was also anti-Zionist. So it's interesting that the anti-Zionist orientation has now turned around to represent a very intransigent stance that not one piece of land can be given up. Now, Lubavitcher Rebbe himself said that was not inconsistent, because his position was that giving up any bit of land would endanger Jews. It has nothing to do with a state of Israel, he said. It has nothing to do with Israel. Does the same thing would happen in any place where Jews are living. You don't give up territory. In other words, his position was based totally on security. So there's some interesting inconsistencies, and this is, of course, not even discussing the messianic idea of Lubavitch. Many people feel a deep sense of regret at this particular issue. As you know, within the Lubavitch movements, even when the Rebbe was alive, there were many who thought that he was the Moshiach. He did not confirm or deny it specifically. There are different hints, and people are reading hints into what he said, but he never said, yes, I am, and he never said, no, he isn't. And then the last 5 years of his life, he was incapacitated by a stroke, and the activity just got more and more active, and it was thought that when he died, it was thought, well, that would end it, because it's the other religion that says the Messiah comes back from the dead. Right, but we see now that many in the movement still believe that the Rebbe is Mashiach, and it's tearing apart the movement. But on the other hand, the outreach activities go on as normal, and the good work that they do is still being done. So the messianic thing is a particular little twist that is unique to Lubavitch, but nevertheless, the outreach, I guess the outstanding features are the extensive outreach, number two, the who is a Jew issue, and number three, not surrendering land for peace, number four, Mashiach. So we have these four particular issues. One thing one must say, though, in credit of Lubavitch, and that is, you know, Lubavitch needs a lot of money because they conduct a lot of activities. They need much more outside money than any other Hasidic movement because they're all over the place. And taking stands on who is a Jew, whether you agree with it or not, certainly would have had the effect of greatly jeopardizing their primary sources of funding. And to the Rebbe's credits, he refused to let financial consideration, again, without addressing whether the position is right or wrong, but being willing to take a position that severely jeopardizes your financial support is an act of great courage. And the Rebbe was an absolutely consistent individual. I mean, he took a position, he took that position no matter what. And in fact, he talked about the fact that he often, he acquired that characteristic from his father. Keep in mind that Lubavitch is a Russian Hasidic. We've been talking a lot about Polish Hasidic, but to move a little bit into Russia, the late Lubavitch Rebbe grew up in the Stalinist, the early years of Stalin regime. And at that point, he was really, literally, it was a capital crime. If you were caught doing religion, you could be shot, you could be killed. There were Jews who were informers. There was the Yevsexia, the Jewish communists, who were very eager to turn in people and the like. And there were a number of times where the Rebbe's father's life was in danger unless he would recant, and he refused to, you know. In fact, the story goes about the previous Lubavitch Rebbe, that one time, he was being interrogated by the KGB, or it wasn't the KGB, but the earlier Chechnya, or the NKVD. There were different names for the Russian secret police. And they wanted him to inform about the whereabouts of somebody who was teaching children. So he says, I'm not going to give you that information. So the interrogator pulls out a gun and says, this little toy makes a lot of people talk. So the previous Rebbe opened up his shirts and said, you can shoot me now. He says, guns scare people who think there are many gods and only one wife. I mean, you believe in a lot of different things. I believe there are two lives and one God. There's a life after that. I'm not afraid of your gun. He says, you can shoot me right away. And of course, like any bully, sometimes when you just say, it doesn't scare you, the person didn't know what to do, the person just said, get out of here, don't come back. So this notion of courage, I mean, the Rebbe basically said that political pressure doesn't bother him because he's been through worse and he's able to get over that. So Lubavitch really has much to admire about it. It is a very consistent movement. Again, whether you agree with what they believe in or not, they are not swayed by financial considerations. That's a big problem. There is no particular leadership. There is the administrative leadership of the Lubavitch, which comprises around four of the elders of the movement. But they function primarily as caretakers, and they have very little control over the underlings. I'll give you a very graphic example. I was in Crown Heights. They're located in Crown Heights, primarily, but they have a big presence in Israel as well. I was in Crown Heights, and the main synagogue has like 2,000 people in it. Uh-oh. And after services, they dance around singing about the Mashiach is coming, and the Rebbe's Mashiach, and the like. Now, where are the leaders? The leaders are actually against this because they feel that it's not proper. Even if you believe it, it's not proper to make a big deal because it antagonizes people and the like. So the leaders have no control. So they have a private little minyan in the Rebbe's office. They don't even go. See, you're all just like shouting around. It's almost like the ego, like the golden calf, and dancing around and singing around and everything else. And the leaders just don't even just let them do what they do. You can't control it. So there's kind of an application. But the amazing thing about Lubavitch is that the Rebbe created such an effective, decentralized system that all of the different Chabad houses, which operate independently, are able to do their thing regardless of the confusion and turmoil at the central office. So the Rebbe created a structure that can survive a lot of different things. You go to a Chabad house, and the classes are still being given, and the activities of the camps are being run, and the schools are being created, in spite of all this crazy thing that's going on in Crown Heights. So the Rebbe was very masterful in giving people the autonomy and the kind of independence to be able to continue to do things, even if there's not that much of a leadership.
But in the old days, whoever had the different areas would come back to the rug, to the Rebbe, for instruction.
What they're kind of doing is, they're kind of doing something similar to Breslov. Breslov has not had a Rebbe for 200 years. Now, with this Rebbe, they have videotapes. They play videotapes all the time. They have cassettes. They have hundreds of volumes. Every word that he said has been written down. And not only that, but they're constantly unearthing new things. Now, it used to be the volumes that were published were the formal discourses on Shabbats. Like pages of volumes. You have hundreds of volumes in 40 years. Now they're finding like things that he said, in private meetings, casual remarks at the dinner table. I mean, they're pretty good publications, like trying to scrape every word, every sentence. They're publishing private diaries that he wrote when he was a boy. So they're really trying to get as much as they can get from the collection of his teaching. Right, so again, that's a totally separate group.
Does this outreach consist of trying to get Jews to join Chabad and become, you know, part of the Chabad?
This is a very controversial question. Overtly, directly, the Lubavitch claim is, we don't care if you're Lubavitch or you're not Lubavitch. We just want you to become more Jewish. And generally speaking, the outreach is directed to increasing connection to the Jewish people and doing more mitzvot, one little mitzvah. Internally, however, there is some indication that the ultimate goal is that you should be a Lubavitch or Chassid. The proof is because a lot of what is taught is Lubavitch philosophy, Tanya, and things like that. But, you know, I think it depends on the individual doing the outreach work. I think some are that and some are that. Somebody once asked how many Lubavitchers are there in the world. The answer to that is, how many Jews are there? That's how many we have. Yeah. So the ultimate goal might be that. But, of course, only a fraction of people of the influence ever become Lubavitch or Chassid. But if one becomes a little bit more observant, that's a good thing, too. Now, what I want to talk about in the remaining moments is, if you turn to the first page of the chart, there are two good Hasidic leaders who are not mentioned here because they are not in this line of succession. One is Rav Nachman of Breslov, and I'm going to give a whole session on this maybe next week. Rav Nachman of Breslov is actually a genealogical descendant. He's a great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. But he is not a disciple of anybody. He's kind of a self-taught person. So he's not in this chart. See, this is not a chart of genealogy. This is a chart of spiritual instruction. Rav Nachman of Breslov is not a disciple of anybody, although he's a great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. And we're going to talk about Rav Nachman because he was a very, very fascinating person. And he was a person that was rejected by many of the Hasidic leaders because he didn't fit in. He struck out, he struck his own way. There are Breslover Hasidim to this very day. Rav Nachman died in 1810, and they never got another Rebbe. But the Breslover Hasidim are called the Taiter Hasidim, which in Yiddish means the dead Hasidim, because they won't be mentioned. And Rav Nachman, of course, is also known not only as a Rebbe, but as a great storyteller. Rav Nachman was the one who developed his own stories in trying to communicate Chassidut. And he was once asked, why does he employ the story form as a way of communicating Chassidut? And he said, well, you know, the teachings are sometimes complicated, and every story is designed to teach you something. If you don't get the teaching, then you should get the story. You know, if all I would do is give you a teaching, if you wouldn't get the teaching, you have nothing. If I tell you a story with the teaching, you don't get the teaching, you at least have the story. Just one famous story of Rav Nachman. It's interesting that many people actually trace Rav Nachman's stories to various European folk tales. There are various influences and the like. But this is the story about the person who was very, very poor, and he had a dream that if he would travel thousands of miles to Vienna and dig under a bridge, he would find a wonderful treasure. And, you know, he ignores the dream, but after a while it keeps on coming back. So he travels thousands of miles to Vienna on foot, and he sees the bridge, exactly as he saw it in his dream, and he waits until the middle of the night, and he starts digging a little bit every day. Eventually he gets apprehended by a policeman. The policeman says, what are you doing? Are you a spy? And the Jew says, well, no, I had this dream in my little shtetl in Poland that if I would travel 2,000 or 3,000 miles,
I would find a treasure. So the person starts laughing at him and says, you stupid Jew, you think dreams mean anything? I had a dream that if I would travel 3,000 miles to some Jew's hut in Poland and dig under the bed, I would find a treasure. Think I'd pay attention? Of course, that was under that Jew's bed. So he traveled all the way back, he dug under the bed, and he found the treasure. The lesson is, Rav Nachman said, that there's an immense treasure that is right next to us at all times. Sometimes we have to travel thousands of miles just to discover what it is that we have. And that was one famous parable. Another famous parable is about the prince who thought he was a chicken. Again, it's a famous story. There was a prince who somehow got ill, got insane, and he took off his clothes and he started crawling on all fours and eating scraps off the floor because he thought he was a chicken. And none of the doctors could cure him. Finally, a man comes and says, you know, I can cure him. And the man gets on all fours and takes off his clothes. So the prince looks at him and says, what are you doing? And the man says, I'm a chicken too. So the two chickens eating scraps. Eventually, the man gets up, puts on his pants. So the prince says, what are you doing? He says, who says chickens can't wear pants? So basically, the way it worked was that instead of disabusing the prince that he was a chicken, like the prince said he was a chicken, the man showed a chicken can wear pants, a chicken can talk, a chicken can walk upright, a chicken can have a job. Meaning to say that sometimes, again, it's not that ever tells you what the point of the story is, we don't just have to try to figure it out, but sometimes the point is we define ourselves, we box ourselves in, we say, I'm this type of person, I'm not capable of doing these great things because I'm X and I'm not Y. And Rav Nachman's lesson is, don't let your label limit you. In other words, you can be a chicken and you can do this anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to say, because I'm not that, therefore. Don't allow that self-image to limit your horizons. Mm-hmm. Do what is good, do what is proper, do what is noble, even if you're not that kind of person. And of course, the irony is, you become that kind of person by that type of behavior. Yeah, that was another story. These are short ones, or some of Rachman's stories are very short. He also has very, very complex stories, which are stories within stories. He has a story of the seven beggars, which I'm not going to be able to summarize here, in which seven beggars show up at a wedding. And each beggar has to tell a story in order to get something to eat. And the stories have stories within stories within stories within stories within stories. And these are very, very long and massive. Rav Nachman, just like Samuel Johnson had a Boswell who recorded every word, Rav Nachman himself had a disciple, Rav Natan, Rav Nathan, who just took down everything, just followed Rav Nachman around and took down everything Rav Nachman said, and that is the basis of the corpus we have today. Breslov is actually a vibrant movement, relatively small, but very, very vibrant, very emotional. Rav Nachman's concepts deal very much. Now, Lubavitch, as it were, tries to conquer the world. Breslover deals with the struggles of the individual. For example, Breslov deals a lot with depression, loneliness, anxiety. It talks to people about those particular issues. And in fact, there's a whole movement in Breslov now that puts out what you might call self-help pamphlets based on Rav Nachman's teaching. How to deal with depression, how to have a good marriage. I mean, they're written kind of a popular vein. How to be a good parent, how to give your kids self-confidence. Kind of, you know, the same type of stuff you get in Borders or, you know, bookstore, the self-help section. They write these self-help books based on the teachings of Rav Nachman.
Where are they located
now? Breslov is, again, in Brooklyn, but Jerusalem is connected. Now, as you would expect, although there is no figure in Breslov, the only Rebbe is Rav Nachman himself. But there is a person who is called the leader. There is somebody who is kind of considered to be the authoritative expositor. And there is a person in Jerusalem who is Rav Bernstein, who is the Yoshev Rosh, the chairman of Breslov. But he is not called the Rebbe. But Breslov is very, very attractive to people who are struggling with personal issues. Because it's a very, very intimate, warm chassidus that stresses psychological conflict. And Nachman himself constantly talked about, he called himself a moon person. he waxes and wanes. Ravnachman himself, now again, it could very well be Ravnachman himself suffered from depression. It's not entirely clear. But there were psychological struggles that he talked a lot about. Mm-hmm. And loneliness, despair, feeling far from God and coming near to God. And those are the things that Rav talks a lot about.
There isn't a Hasidic movement here, per se, but in Baltimore, they have. Which movement would probably be the most represented there? Or are they all little bits of everybody?
Yeah, the truth of the matter is, there is a Lubavitch group, which is everywhere, of course. The only other Hasidic... Okay, I'll tell you, it's very, very fascinating. The only Hasidic synagogues that are there are actually Satmar and Munkach. However, you have to understand, there are no Satmar and Munkach Hasidim in Baltimore. In other words, the institution of those institutions. And then you have either generic Hasidim, all other groups, or you have not Hasidim in Baltimore. Right. It's a pleasant place. So there is no Hasidic center in Baltimore, per se. Other than Lubavitch, which is kind of everywhere. Yeah, but Nei Yisrael is not a Hasidic yeshiva. Nei Yisrael is a Lithuanian yeshiva.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that,
Baltimore is largely a Mitnagei town. So it's not
really a Mitnagei town. Right.
But there's no movement that's going to be in Baltimore. So, if you go to the Hasidic synagogue, you'll see people of all Hasidic of all types, and a lot of non-Hasidic as well, who like the singing, who like the atmosphere.
Can you point out on this chart where Braslov is?
Yes, well, I put it, Braslov does not belong to this chart, and the reason is because Rav Nachman of Braslov, although he was a great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, is a self-taught person. He did not receive from any of these groups, which is why the Hasidic movements turned against him. A lot of the Rebbe's turned against him because he was his own person. He was very independent. Rav Nachman, by the way, made a number of statements that he thought he might be the Mashiach. He had certain messianic beliefs himself. Rav Nachman was buried. He happened to die in Ukraine, in Uman. And his grave became a pilgrimage site for many Breslover Hasidim. And the truth is, the grave is not in the cemetery. The grave is in some woman's backyard. And she made a lot of money, that family made a lot of money over the years in charging people to go visit. And keep in mind, now it's fairly easy to get there. But keep in mind that during Stalinist era of life, people made pilgrimages at great risk to their life. One of the distinguishing features of Breslov Hasidus is Rav Nachman taught the importance of what is called Hitzbodedutz. Hitzbodedutz is a Breslov practice that you have to take time from every day to talk to God in your own language, in a private place, in isolation. Hitzbodedut is to be isolated with God. And typically they would go in the middle of the night, they'd go to a lonely place outside, and they would scream and talk at the top of their lungs to God. And somehow they would relieve themselves of the burdens of life, talk to God in a conversational way. In fact, there's a very interesting book, you really should read this, we're going to be interested in Hasidut at all. A Reform rabbi, Herbert Weiner, wrote a book, 9 1/2 Mystics. He wrote this around 20 years ago. And in his youth, in the 40s and the 50s, he explored all sorts of mystical movements. In fact, he had a fascinating interview with the Lubavitch Rebbe back in 1954. Ivan Steinsaltz, when he was still single, just very, very interesting. Everybody. So he has a long discussion about Breslover Hasidus, which he also explored. And he talked about the fact that in 1948, he went with the Breslover Hasid and the outskirts of Jerusalem to be mitzvadeit. And he just felt very, very nervous as he heard the bombs going up. It was right in the no man's land of Jerusalem between the Jordanian borders. And he said he found it hard to concentrate as the bombs were going off. But finally, he made a prayer to God, "God, just get me out of here alive." That was his brother Dux. And then afterwards, he went to an ice-cold mikvah of water. He couldn't do it. And he just noticed how Hasidim were going in one after the other. And he just couldn't. Very interesting, but that's Breslov. And Breslov still, is very, very introspective because it's a small group, but it's a. If you, I don't know if you ever see their booklets, but I know if you know, every year we have a restless person who comes to collect money for the institution. They always leave like 20 of these little self-help books about how to have a good marriage, how not to lose your temper, you know, things like that. So they're very into character developments, personality developments, and the like. So that is Breslau.
I'm getting the sense that the idea of the Rebbe being Mashiach is very unique to the Lubavitch. Is that so?
Well, yes. In fact, Lubavitch has a tradition. By the way, this is not the first Rebbe of whom they thought was Mashiach. They thought the previous Rebbe may have been Mashiach, and they thought the one before could have been Mashiach. So the concept of Mashiach, the Rebbe being Mashiach, is not a totally new to this Rebbe. Now, Lubavitch will point out that there's Talmudic precedent to believe that your spiritual leader is Mashiach. The Talmud says, for example, the Talmud discusses, what will the name of Mashiach be? So it says, the disciples of Rav Shila, that's a name, say his name will be Shila. The disciples of Rav Yanai says his name will be Yanai. We suggest that, you know, you identify your teacher as Mashiach. But of course, that doesn't necessarily mean the person. That could just refer to the ideas that my teacher embodies will be the ideas of the Mashiach. But they say every person should believe that Rebbe is Mashiach. That's what Lubavitch says. But Lubavitch seems to have stressed it more than others. And Breslov, perhaps, as well. But the other movements have not made it. The other movements could talk about their Rebbe being able to bring the Mashiach. Or their Rebbe will be the one who greets the Mashiach. But they have not said their Rebbe is Mashiach. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. The next one I want to talk about is Rabbi Yisrael Friedman, another breakaway dynasty, founder of the dynasty of Rajin in Sadegora. The reason that's very interesting is Rajin, I'll tell you one final story. Rajin was also a great grandson of the Maggid of Meserich, but did not learn from them. The Rajinian Rebbe became Rebbe at the age of 16, and it was a breakaway dynasty. And it became very, very influential. But Rajin believed in luxury. The Rajinian dynasty lived like kings. They lived in marvelous palaces, which had the finest architects of France and Italy, etc. All the children wore these Italian fashions and everything else. There was really a concentration on great, great luxury. The Reziner said that a Rebbe is a melech, is a king, and there is a concept of living in malchut as a way of inspiring people. And we'll discuss exactly what that was. He did end with some kind of scandal, but we'll leave that for next week. Okay. If you have the chart, that's the two charts that were passed out last week. One involves the general listing of the masters of the Hasidic movements. And then there's a whole separate chart which traces the disciples of the Chozel of Lublin, who was the progenitor of most Hasidic movements in Poland, including the Hasidut of Ger, which did become the largest Hasidic group in Poland, and even today is one of the largest in the world. I want to go back a little bit, though, and continue our discussion of the Kutzker, the Rebbe of Kutsk, because although, again, he's a little out of our chronological sequence at this point, there were a number of very, very interesting teachings and stories and vignettes which may shed a little bit more light on this very complicated and difficult-to-understand personality. Here, I have to say that Buber's book is very, very good. I think Buber himself was very fascinated with the Kutzker Rebbe because he was kind of a cantankerous character and enjoyed exploring the various subtleties of his personality. So if you have the Tales of the Hasidim with you, I'll just give you some pages and I just want to go over. I'm not going to go over it paragraph by paragraph, obviously, but I want to point out selectively. We pointed out a few of them, but I see that I had a list of some other things I wanted to call to your attention.
Which page?
I'm just looking at this. First, look at page 272. Buber recounts a conversation that Rabbi Mendel once had with Rav Bunim. Remember, Rav Bunim was Rav Simcha Bunim, who of Peshitska, who was the Kutzke Rebbe's teacher. Remember, too, that although in terms of personality, Reb Menachem Mendel and Reb Simcha Bunim were very different. Simcha Bunim was a very, very gentle person. Reb Menachem Mendel was kind of caustic. But nevertheless, Reb Menachem Mendel had a tremendous loyalty and love for Reb Simcha Bunim. And there's a conversation here. Rabbi Bunim once said to Rabbi Mendel, his disciple, "If I am sentenced to hell, what shall I do?"
What page
is it? Page 272. It's called a conversation. "If I am sentenced to hell, what shall I do?" Mendel was silent. You know, his teacher says, "If I go to hell," then that's not something that these disciples can mention. After a while, Rabbi Bunim said, "This is what I'll do. Our sages say, if a disciple is banished, his teachers are banished together with him. Well then, I shall say, bring me my teachers, the seer of Lublin and the holy Yehudi." Mendel answered, "This of course cannot come as far as you are concerned, but knowing it can be of great use to me." Now again, even to understand a simple little story like that, you have to understand the way of Polish Hasidut in particular is there was such a facility with Talmud and halakha that even in casual conversations and stories, halachot are interspersed. For example, you might not know, this is referring to a passage in the Talmud. The Talmud talks about exile, actually the Torah talks about exile to a city of refuge for the punishment of killing somebody inadvertently. This is a mitzvah in the Torah, that if I'm climbing down a ladder and I fall off a ladder and I fall on somebody, I commit what might be called manslaughter, unintentional, inadvertence, homicide. So it is not a capital crime, but rather there is what is called galut, exile, to the cities of refuge. This is in the Chumash itself. Now, there is a passage in the Talmud that states this fascinating halakha, amazing halakha. If one is a disciple of a great sage, and the disciple inadvertently kills, when the disciple goes to the Ir Miklatz, his teacher must go with him. Why is that? Because since the Torah describes the Ir Miklat as a place where the convicted assailant can live, the Talmud says, what is life when you don't share it with the master that gives you wisdom? So this is actually halakha. So this is what Rav Bunim said. Rav Bunim said, well, if I go to hell, that's a form of exile for my sins. I'll have to bring the Chazer of Lublin with me, based on the Talmud passage. And the Kutzke and Rav Nachum Mendel says, well, that certainly doesn't apply to you, but I'll use it against you if it ever happens to me. So you see here, at least, that Rabbi Mendel, in spite of the fact that he was often very difficult with people, did have a certain degree of modesty and humility in recognizing how great his Rebbe was, and perhaps that he himself had certain faults. There is another passage. Again, I'm just going to show you selective things. This is actually very worthwhile to read in its totality. This is probably the best treatment of any of the Rebbe's in the work. This is book two. This is volume two. Yeah, remember, this is in this one volume, there's two volumes here. So this is page 272 of volume two, towards the end of the book. Let me just have my list here. Look on page 274. There is another very famous remark. In a fur coat. This is also very well known. It's a Yiddish saying, a tzaddik in a mitzvah pelts. And this is from the Kutzke Rebbe. It says, the Rebbe of Kutzke once said of a famous rabbi, that is a tzaddik in a fur coat. His disciples asked him what he meant by this. Well, he explained, one man buys himself a fur coat in winter, another person buys kindling. What is the difference between them? The first wants to keep only himself warm, and the second wants to give warmth to others too. The concept is that there is the tzaddik that is concerned for his own spiritual welfare, so he puts on a coat when it's cold, but then there's the tzaddik that is concerned with others, and he buys the wood. This was actually, since it's part of, again, Buber excerpted these things from longer discussions, this was actually part of an analysis describing the difference between Noah and Abraham. That we find that when God tells Noah that I'm going to bring a flood to destroy the worlds because they are corrupt, Noah's response is to build the ark. Mm-hmm. Of course, at God's bidding, to protect himself. When God tells Abraham that he's going to destroy the evildoers of Sodom, Abraham's concern is not to save himself, But Abraham's concern is to reach out and try to save the people of Sodom. And that is why we commonly say, actually, that Abraham is the first Jew, whatever that term means. But that's not a very precise term anyway. But we identify the Jewish people as coming from Abraham instead of Noah, primarily because of this notion that a Jew must always seek to bring light and warmth to others as well as themselves, as opposed to creating the hermetically sealed environment that keeps others out but protects you on the inside. So this expression, the tzaddik in health, the tzaddik in a fur coat, originates from a bon mot of the...
It's not very fair to Noah, because when God wanted to bring the flood, he ordered to build the Beit Ark, so in order that the wicked people would see this procedure,
right,
and they would ask them what good
it was. And in fact, it took, according to the rabbis of the Midrash, Noah spent 120 years building the Ark.
They had time to get this sent.
But when push came to shove, Abraham took the initiative of actually challenging God.
Noah
did not challenge. So it raises an interesting issue. Does one challenge God or does one accept? We find that Abraham is elevated and blessed precisely because he took that extra step to seek mercy for others. So that's another teaching of the Kutzker. Again, I want to just point out these are very famous thoughts that people who are familiar with Hasidut are familiar with, and little vertlech, as we say, little words of Torah. These are things that one should see. If you look at, see here, turn to page 277. And again, to fully understand these, you have to know that commonly what the Kutzker Rebbe does, as the whole school of Peshitzka does, is they take like passages from the Talmud and they give kind of a new interpretation or twist to them. Look at immersion, 277. This is what the Rabbi of Kutsk said concerning Rabbi Akiva's saying that God is the waters of immersion of Israel. The waters of immersion only purify the soul if one is wholly immersed, so not a hair is showing. That is how we should be immersed in God. Now again, let me explain the background. Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, states in the Mishnah, he has a pun. See how everything is building? It starts off with a verse in Jeremiah. The verse in Jeremiah says, Mikveh Yisrael Hashem. Now literally that means, God is the hope of Israel. Mikveh comes from tikvah. But Rabbi Akiva adduces a pun, because we also know a mikveh is a collection of water. And therefore, Mikveh Yisrael Hashem could also be translated that God is a mikveh for the Jewish people. And Rabbi Akiva says, just as the mikveh purifies the impure, so too God purifies the sins of the Jewish people. Now the Kutzker Rebbe takes that, so Rabbi Akiva's teaching is built on a pun of a biblical verse in Jeremiah, but the Kutzker Rebbe says, it's very interesting that the purification of God is comparable to a mikveh, because the halacha of a mikveh is very, very clear that the entire body must be immersed. If even one little hair is above the water, the immersion is invalid. Therefore the Kutzker Rebbe says, if you want God to be your mikveh, you have to be totally immersed in godliness. You can't do it as a sideline. You can't compromise. Of course, this was the Kutzker Rebbe's great teaching of not compromising, not going in the middle of the road. Buber doesn't quote this, but the Kutzker Rebbe was the one who said that only horses walk in the middle of the road. And if you walk in the middle of the road, you know, you'll step into the stuff that the horses leave behind. So contrary to Maimonides, who advocated the notion of moderation and walking in the middle, the Kutzker Rebbe said, where's moderation? One has to be zealous and enthusiastic and fully committed. It's very difficult. Indeed, this is part of the problem that many Jews face today. It is very difficult to be a passionate moderate. Now, that doesn't mean it's not, perhaps not more true than extremities. But the point is, it's difficult to be passionate about being in the middle of things. And indeed, the Kutzker was very much against the concept of moderation. He felt total immersion. And he actually adduces this from Rabbi Akiva's idea that God is the mikveh of Israel, in which there must be that that total immersion. On that same page,
Look at the next, well, God's dwelling is a very famous remark. God's dwelling, I'm sure you've heard it. Where is the dwelling of God? This was the question with which the Rebbe of Kutz surprised a number of learned men who happened to be visiting him. They laughed at him. What a thing to ask. Is not the whole world full of his glory? But then he answered his own question. God dwells wherever man lets him. Where does God live? God lives where he's welcome. Again, there are different versions of this. God lives where he's welcomed. God lives where he's let in, etc. The concept that every person is a repository of godliness. That God dwells within our consciousnesses if we just let him in. And he's waiting to enter. Now, this is a thought, once again, that can be certainly based on earlier sources. Go back to the construction of the tabernacle. The tabernacle, the Mishkan, the Beit HaMikdash. So in Exodus, what does it say? God says to Moshe, V'yasu li mikdash, they shall make a temple for me, v'shachanti b'tocham, so that I may dwell within them. It does not say in the Torah, they shall make me a temple, v'shachanti b'tocho, in it, but rather, the real place where God's presence resides is within the hearts and souls of human beings. Temples, synagogues, these are symbols, and often human beings need symbols to be inspired. We are that, in fact, by the way, that's another thing. The Kutzke Rebbe was a person who was profoundly indifferent to symbolism. I mean, part of, again, in his search for that truth and for that inner experience, he really tried to remove a lot of externally aesthetic forms. We're going to see a Hasidic rabbi who went to the opposite extreme, the Rezina Rebbe, who elevated form to a sublime art. The Kutzker was a nihilist in terms of form. In other words, the idea would be that people dressed in rags, they lived in poverty, the synagogues were not beautiful, they were specifically made to be very uninspiring, because he said, don't be distracted, focus on the internal experience. Nevertheless, we do know that human beings often need externalities to inspire them, music, nice building, etc. But nevertheless, the ultimate Shekhinah is B'tochan, within us. In fact, if I could digress for a second, there's an interesting comment of Nachmanides. Again, Ramban, who predated the Hasidic movement by hundreds and hundreds of years, so Ramban was not a Hasid by any means, but the Ramban makes the point that, according to rabbinic tradition, the home of Sarah, the home of Sarah Imenu, was exemplified by three miraculous occurrences that existed in her home. One was there was a blessing in the bread that she made. As if you ate her bread, it sustained you for a long time. And number two, the nair, the candle that she lit for Shabbat, lasted the whole week. And number three, there was a cloud of glory over her home that corresponded to the divine presence that rested there. According to the Midrash, when Sarah died, these three miracles left. And when it says, and Yitzchak brought Rivka, we read last week of the marriage, so it says he brought her, La'ohel Imo, to the tent of his mother, and he loved her. So according to the Midrash, although Rivka was a very young girl, according to some, she was only 3 years old. Okay, without getting into that issue, which is a difficult issue, but it does say that all of the miracles were restored. Now, Nachmanides makes the following observation. If you look at the miracles that are associated with the Mishkan, you can see that they're in some level comparable to the miracles of the tent of Sarah. For example, the blessing in the bread corresponds to the showbread. There was bread that was put on the shulchan, on a table in the Mikdash, or the Mishkan, in the temple later. And it was put there on Shabbat, and it was left there for the whole week until next Shabbat, when it was taken off the table and eaten, and it was still fresh and warm, miraculously. That corresponds to the blessing in Sarah's bread. The candle, the Shabbat candle, corresponds to the Ner Tamid. There was a candle in the menorah that's perpetually, right? We have that over the ark in commemoration of that, the Ner Tamid. And finally, of course, the Mishkan is described in the Torah as being enveloped by God's clouds. Now, the Ramban says the following. The Ramban says, therefore, there is a correlation
between Mishkan and Saris Tet, because in effect, the Mishkan was nothing more than an attempt to replicate the holiness of a Jewish home. In other words, it is the Jewish home, as exemplified by the tent of Sarah, that is the real holiness, and the Mishkan is that imitation of what that holiness is. You know, of course, obviously, as educators, all of you know that the major movement in Jewish education today is family education and the like, and it's absolutely very, very clear. It is a fundamental premise of Jewish religious practice and philosophy that the home is considerably more important than any of the other institutions that one has. And the holiness, God's presence, is manifest in the relationship of husband and wife and parent and children. And then all the other institutions flow from that. Ramban says it. This is the Kutzker Rebbe's point, that God does not dwell in the synagogue. God dwells in the heart of the person who opens his heart to let God in. And in particular, combining that with not being a tzaddik in a fur coat, we see that part of letting God in means opening up your heart to include others. In other words, it's all connected. It's the way we reach out to others that allows our hearts to be open to receive that. So that's also, again, a very well-known comment, but a comment that's worthwhile to look at, because I don't want you to get, you know, a totally negative picture of the Kutzker Rebbe, who is a very difficult person to understand. Finally, on that same page, look at the bottom of page 277.
On the whole, it looks compared to the other Hasidic rebbeins, does it have like this original twist that many of them don't have? Does he have a special personality to himself?
He was very, you know, his thoughts are often distinguished by a certain sharpness, sometimes a biting humor, sometimes a touch of sarcasm, as you would expect, although the ones I'm reading are not necessarily representative of that. But the truth is, a lot of it came from Rabbunim. Rabbunim himself was a very, very original person, kind of the Zertel, or the Chap, as he's saying it, is kind of the ingenious twist, something that Rabbunim excelled in, and the Kutzker kind of just took that a little further. Rav Bunim, we discussed, was a very worldly person. Rav Bunim was called the worldly Hasidic Rebbe, and you know, so part of that came from his exposure to many, many different types of people. Look at fathers and sons. Again, this is a very, very beautiful one also. Again, same page, 277. I know that you could read this, but I'm assuming that not everybody read this page to page, so I think it's worthwhile just to call your attention to the teachings. A man came to the rabbi of Kutsk and complained of his sons, who refused to support him, though he was old and no longer able to earn his own livelihood. You know the old Yiddish saying, one father takes care of 10 children, or one parent, and 10 children cannot take care of one parent. I was always ready to do anything at all for them, and now they won't have anything to do with me. Silently, the rabbi raised his eyes to heaven. That's how it is, he said softly. The father shares in the sorrow of his sons, but the sons do not share in the sorrow of their father. Mm-hmm. He's talking to God, and he says, that's the way it is. That God is so much involved in our pains and our concerns, but we don't think about God. He says, that's the way it is, you know. The parent worries about the children, and the children do not worry about the parent. Then look at the next one, the vessel. A disciple of Rabbi Mendel told the story in his old age, shortly before he died. I shall tell you the first saying I heard from the rabbi. I heard many after that, but this was the first he kindled. With this first he kindled my heart forever. It was on the Sabbath eve after the benediction of sanctification. That's Kiddush. The rabbi sat in his big chair. His face was transformed as though his soul had left his body and was floating about him. He stretched out his arms with a gesture of great decision. He poured water over our hands, which is interesting, he actually washed their hands, spoke the benediction over the bread, the hamotzi, and broke the bread. Then he said, in this world, there are sages, students, and thinkers. They all think of and study the mystery of God. But what can they find out about it? No more than they can grasp from their realm of reason. But the holy children of Israel have a vessel. It is to do God's will, and with this vessel they can hold more than is accorded their realm, and they can grasp what is accorded on the rung of the ministering angels. This is what is meant by the words spoken at Sinai. We do, we hear.
It is with our doing that we grasp. Again, this is based on a biblical verse. When the Jews received the Torah at Mount Sinai, so we have the famous declaration, Kol Asher Diber Hashem, all that God has stated, Na'aseh V'nishma, Na'aseh, we will do, V'nishma, and we will listen, or we will understand. You know, in Hebrew, Shema, both has the connotation of hearing and understanding. Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel, also means understand, contemplate, absorb. And the Kutzker Rebbe is making the point, which is not original with him, although he's making the point here, is that in a very mystical sense, the Havanah, the understanding of mitzvot, cannot exist apart from their observance. Meaning to say, it's not as if you first understand and then you do, because as he says, a reason is a rung on the ladder that might be fairly low. If we regard spiritual striving as a ladder that connects to God, the rung that one can reach with reason is a fairly low rung. But the rung that one can reach with unconditional submission to that will open up the gates and elevate a person to a much higher level. And he says that is the meaning of Na'aseh V'nishma, through the action, through the doing, through the commitments, we come to insights. And rather than have the insight give rise to the commitments, he says there must be the commitments first, which then gives rise to the insight. And that is, again, the idea of Na'aseh. Of course, there are many interpretations of Na'aseh V'nishma, but one of them is the commitment must precede the understanding, and then the understanding comes. Similarly, the next thought about Shavuot, why is the Feast of Weeks, that Shavuot, called the time the Torah was given? Now, what do we call Shavuot in Hebrew? Zaman Matan Torah, the day that the Torah was given. Now, we know that Pirkei Avot, for example, talks about Moshe receiving the Torah. Moshe kibel Torah Misinai. Now, you could also say, therefore, instead of calling Shavuot Zaman Matan Torah Teinu, you could call it Zaman Kabbalat Torah Teinu. In fact, it's very, very common in everyday speech. We talk about Shavuot as Kabbalat Torah. So look what the Kutzker Rebbe says. He says a very beautiful answer, which is very true. He says, the giving took place on the day commemorated by the feast, but the receiving takes place at all times.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
The insight is, God gave the Torah once, but you have to receive it every day. Again, in this short phrase, he's emphasizing the concept of renewal. Every day is a new choice. Every day is a new commitment. You don't keep Shabbat this week because you kept it last week. This is supposed to be new experiences, not to rest on your laurels, the notion of constant striving. And therefore, it is only Matan Torah that is a one-time event. But Kabbalat Torah is something a Jew does every single day of their lives. And that is why Shavuot does not call it Kabbalat Torah. In a similar way, you know, it is said that in the morning brachot that are in the Siddur, again, I'm not sure if conservative movement may have changed it, but they're phrased in the negative. Shalom, I'm sure they're not going to touch the issue about Isha. That's not my interest tonight. But I want to touch on Shalom Asani Goy. Did not make me a Goy. And the question becomes, why is that not worded in the affirmative? Shoasani Yisrael. Now, I think some have tried to amend it, Shoasani Yisrael. Is that in the... Okay, I understand. And there is a source for that, but nevertheless, the classic Nusach, the classic text, has accentuated the negative, not the positive. But it's been said the following. This is a very interesting point. God doesn't make you a Jew. You make yourself a Jew. In other words, the most you can say to God is, God gave me the ability to practice Judaism by not making me a Goy. But whether I become a Jew is up to how I live my life. Meaning you can't thank you God for making me a Jew, because that's what you make yourself. That is the Kabbalat Torah that you have to do every single day. At least that would explain the traditional Nusach. I just have few more. Yeah, I have a few teachings here which are not in Buber's book, so I'll just tell you them. Outside. There's a famous remark, the Kutzker Rebbe was once very, very, he was constantly disappointed about the fact that people were living for their children. This was something that bothered him. In fact, he once said that he would love to meet that final child at the end of time for which the entire universe had been working. Because particularly in Avodat Hashem, in the service of God, when we have children or we're concerned about our children, you know, practicing Judaism, our children going to school, etc., but we neglect our own mitzvot, our own Torah, because we're doing it for the kids. And then when the kids grow up, they may abandon their mitzvot because they're doing it for their kids, etc. So the Kutzker Rebbe said, gee, I'm just waiting to see that final kid that everybody's doing it for. And he emphasized the fact that, which of course is educationally very sound, that the best way you teach your children what is important in life is not by lecturing, but by doing it yourself, incorporating it yourself. In fact, this was even said with regarding tefillah. You know, many synagogues have problems of excessive talking during during prayers. It's a big problem. So it was said that if all your kids see is that you tell them to be quiet during prayer services, what they learn is that when they have kids, they'll tell their kids to be quiet during prayer services. It's only if they see you being quiet that they will actually learn that lesson as well. That was one teaching. Another teaching that he said about prayer is a person once came to him and said, you know, I have sickness in my family and I don't have parnasa, I'm poor, and I'm just in a lot of trouble. So the Kutzker Rebbe said, no problem, just pray to God. He says, no, I really can't concentrate on prayer. He says, oh, now you got a real problem. The problem in life, he says, is not the externals. The problem in life is the inability to enter into prayer. And I think, again, I may have told you this, there's a beautiful teaching from Rav Simcha Bunim, which I think makes the point even more beautifully. Rav Simcha Bunim asked the question, you know, the snake was cursed in the beginning of Genesis, that it would always crawl on its belly and eat dirt all the days of its life. So Rav Simcha Bunim asked the question, what's wrong with eating dirt? You never have to look for your food. It's always available.
Yeah.
In fact, the Talmud says, even God's curses are merciful because the snake always has dirt. So Rav Simcha Bunim says, no, the greatest curse is the snake will never have occasion to pray to God for its mizonot, for its food. It's as if God is saying, I am so disgusted with you, I'll give you everything you want, so you won't bother me. And Rav Simcha Bunim says that what you see here is that sometimes the existence of unfulfilled needs within a human being are the mechanisms that God creates to enable us to have a relationship with Him. That indeed, it's not that prayer exists to address the need. It's the other way. The real need is prayer. And needs exist to stimulate the person to reach out and enter into a relationship with God. The truth is, the genesis of this thought is actually in the Talmud itself, as virtually everything comes out of the Talmud, where the Talmud says, in a brief statement, why were our matriarchs barren, right? Sarah and Rivka, for many years Rachel, and it says because God wanted their prayers. God wanted them to turn to Him. You know, again, this is not, of course, I mean, this is not really a comprehensive explanation of suffering and everything else, but certainly one of the perspectives of difficulties in life generally is it affords us the ability to let go of our egos, let go of our arrogance, and create that relationship with God, which is like a loving presence that takes us through a dark tunnel. Sometimes you look at a dark tunnel in life and it's very, very fearful. You don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And if one has a sense of God being with them, in fact, looking at the book of Job, for example, again, I'm not going to go into it in length here, but you know, the book of Job is the story, of course, of the prototypical righteous person who seems to be the victim of a capricious bet. You know, God is betting with the Satan, now will Job, you know, break or won't he break, as it were? And God seems to be winning the bet some of the time, but then Job breaks and accuses God of being a God of injustice and the like. And Job's friends say, no, Job, you must be sinful, you must have done something wrong, and Job said, I didn't. And God finally shows up at the end of the book, right? God answers Job out of the whirlwind, the whole book.
Job is, you know, demanding to God, God, I demand that you appear. I summon you to the bar of justice. And, you don't expect in our everyday life, you don't expect God to come out of the whirlwind, but God comes out of the whirlwind. And we finally think, oh, now we're going to get an answer. But if you remember the end of the book of Job, it's a very, very beautiful description of the natural wonders of the worlds. Mountain goats, snow, and rain, but it doesn't seem to answer the question. God seems to be non-responsive. I mean, Job's question is, why should I, as a righteous person who kept all the rules, why should these awful things happen to me? And God shows him mountain goats and snakes and antelopes and the constellations. Right? So that's kind of a diversionary tactic, as it were. And there are a lot of different ways of understanding this. Some say God is just overwhelming Job with his awesome power, kind of saying, better not ask any questions, because, you know, I'm in charge of this whole universe. But in a deeper level, it is said that God is not answering Job, but God is just reassuring Job that there is a divine, benevolent presence in the world, meaning to say that sometimes the way one deals with suffering is not by having a why. The why might be beyond our comprehension, but simply in the serenity of feeling that one has God's presence, that holding hand, as it were, that you're not in it alone. And that's what Rav Bunim said, that sometimes when God is so indifferent to someone, God gives them everything they want. So they never have this sense of need and dependence to enter into that relationship. There's another famous, I think this is not, I'm trying to find my page numbers here. Yeah, look at 283. I just have a few more.
What page? 283?
283. It's again volume 2. Two 283. This is a famous one. Someone once told Rav Mendel that a certain person is greater than another, whom he also mentioned by name. Rav Mendel replied, if I am I because I am I, and you are you because you are you, then I am I and you are you. But if I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not I, and you are not you. Okay. You may have to read that once or twice ahead. But basically, the concept is one of authenticity and not masquerading. If I project a certain persona because I kind of have to change myself because of another person, then I am not really being me. I have to be I because I am I. Then I am I and you are you. But if I am what I am only because of you, then I'm not really I. In other words, the concept. But again, different people could take this different ways. Some people might say, well, what do you mean? In a marriage, isn't it good, to compromise, to modify, to change? But the Kutzker basically says, no, a person has to be true to their own selves, even if that will lead to difficult circumstances, as was the case in his own life. The concept of authenticity, of not imitating. Of course, there's a similar statement, although in a slightly different mood, that I recall reading from Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr. I'm not sure which is the more famous one. For lawyers, the famous Oliver Wendell Holmes is Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who was a justice of the United States Supreme Court. But for students of American literature, the famous one is Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr., who was both a physician, actually a very esteemed physician, but also a poet in Boston. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr. once wrote an essay about why it's so difficult for human beings to communicate. Because he says, whenever one person talks to another person, there are really six people involved in the conversation. There is what I'm saying, there is what I think I'm saying, and there's what I really think, which is not necessarily saying. And when you're talking back to me, you've got the same three people. So he says, listen, if there are six voices talking at the same time, then obviously there's going to be miscommunication and error. And part of what the Kutzke Rebbe is saying is, don't be duplicitous. You know, be one person, be consistent inside and outside, and then there's going to be a sense of authenticity. And in fact, another way in which he expressed that idea is, there is only one thing in the world that cannot be imitated. Everything can be imitated except truth. Truth cannot be imitated, because if you're doing a certain thing because somebody else is doing it, then it is no longer a statement of truth to you. Truth has to come from your own inner perception, and that is a matter of imitating. That, again, this is actually a theme in a lot of Hasidut, which often stresses individuality in the worship of God. They point out that even if you go back to the Avots, each of the Avots served God in a very distinctive manner, based on Kabbalistic ideas. If you remember the first three Sfirot, Chesed, loving kindness, Gevurah is introspection and judgment, Tiferet, which is beauty, is the Mizug, is the mixture of Chesed and Gevurah. We are told that Avraham served God primarily through the attribute of loving kindness. Yitzchak served God through strict judgment and introspection. And Yaakov combined those different midot. Now, it's very interesting that each of the Avot served God in a unique and distinct pathway, which teaches you that one does not serve God by imitation, but one serves God by finding their own unique way. This, of course, is a major challenge both for parents and for educators. On one hand, we have a responsibility to give over a tradition, give over a body of teaching. By definition, any religious community is premised on a certain level of conformity. If you literally adopted the stance where every single person devises their own individual way of serving God, a religious community would not be possible. But the great dilemma and challenge is, how do you create a sense of community, but at the same time recognize the uniqueness and individuality of each person's connection to God? That's a dilemma. Sometimes we veer very far in the level of conformity, and sometimes it becomes anarchic in terms of anarchy, in terms of freewheeling individualism. There has to be a way of trying to incorporate both of those things. In fact, the story is said that a certain Rebbe, I don't remember if it was the Kutzke Rebbe, but it sounds like it might be the Kutzke Rebbe, was once attacked because he was not following the ways of his Rebbe. And his response was, I'm doing exactly as my Rebbe. My Rebbe didn't follow his Rebbe. I don't follow my Rebbe. I'm doing the same thing. The concept of finding one's own pathway. I think we just have just turn to 285. And we'll be finished shortly with this. Miracles. 285, miracles. The Rebbe of Kutsk was told of a wonder worker who was versed in the secret art of making a robot. Now, I think Rupert didn't use the right word here. This is referring to a golem, actually. They were not into robotics. But as you know, there's a whole history and tradition of the golem. The golem is simply a thing, an entity that is made out of clay or dirt, and through the use of the combinations of letters, say Rufei Otiot, in the Sefer Yetzirah, the ancient book of creation, which you can still get. You can get it in the bookstores here, in English even. Tells you how to make a golem. So, you know, I think you'd be able to understand it. And according to legend, the great Maharal, who lived in Prague in only the 16th century, did have a golem which was used to defeat the enemies, etc. And according to tradition, the golem of the Maharal, just as a golem, it's not alive in any way, is still in the attic of the Maharal synagogue in Prague behind locked doors. That's an ancient tradition among the Jews of Eastern Europe, at the Maharal's golem.
But there is
the Maharal. Oh, sure. I mean, the Maharal lived in Prague.
No. In the golem.
What do you mean, where? The grave? In the Prague Cemetery?
In the cemetery there is a tombstone that says,
"Here
lies the golem."
Really?
Yes, I've seen it.
Where?
That's amazing.
In the Altneustadt.
So why do people say it's in the synagogue?
The story goes that Maral removed the olive, of course, and he crumpled back to clay,
right.
And then they transported much of the clay up to the Geniza,
right.
And covered him up with the sporum and things, right. Over there, and left him there.
Right.
So it could be parts of both.
So maybe parts,
sense,
of the clay was
the clay was in this spot. That's,
yeah,
where they
it's hard to bury, you know, you bury the dirt.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, there are various halachic issues regarding the Gola. Can you count a golem for a minion? It'd be very convenient. You only have nine, you know, make a golem. Are you allowed to kill a golem? Now, it's interesting. Now, some people, by the way, you know, I spoke about this the other day. Some, you know, we're on the verge now of at least having the technology to be able to clone a human being.
Yeah.
Through the process of cloning.
Right.
You know, the Dolly, the sheep was cloned.
Right.
And there are some writers that have speculated, although I don't think it's an accurate conclusion, that they have analogized a human clone, which is not produced from sexual reproduction, to the artificial person in halakha, which is the golem. And they have posited that it might be that halakha would not accord human status to a clone. I think that that's very incorrect for a number of reasons. First of all, keep in mind that, you know, people think often, you know, you clone and 2 minutes later you get somebody who looks exactly like you. I mean, cloning is simply a way of replacing the nucleus of an egg with the nucleus from another source. But then it's just a fertilized egg and it has to be implanted into a woman who will carry it for 9 months and will be born a baby. So if you're 30 years old, your clone will look like you 30 years from now, so you'll be 60, your clone will be 30. So a clone is a yulud isha. A clone is born from a woman like other human beings, and therefore in all probability the clone would be human. Moreover, the clone will have organs. The golem does not have organs. The golem is just dirt inside. But being as it may, the Rebbe of Kutsk was told of a wonder worker. Remember, keep in mind that, I think we talked about this, that the whole school of Peshischa, Kutsk, Ger, all of its various branches, was very much against the concept of the Rebbe as wonder worker. They were very much into inspiring people to seek their ways of service of God and not rely on quick fixes or miracles and the like. And yet there were Rebbes in Poland who were very much into the magic and miracles. So somebody told the Kutzker Rebbe, gee, there's a rabbi who can make a golem. And he answered, that is unimportant. The secret art of making a robot is not important. Does he know the secret art of making a chassid? Meaning, how to make a human being is much more significant than how to make a golem. Make a golem is fine. How do you make a human being? And of course, this is again a question about parent faces and teacher faces. How to form that human being is the most difficult task of all. Yeah, 288. This is the last, just two more. Actually, I like Why Write a Book? It's not a particularly profound statement, but I think it shows how the Kutzker Rebbe had a lot of impatience with the world. Rabbi Mendel's Hasidim asked him on page 288, why didn't he write a book? For a while he was silent, and then he answered, let's say I have written a book. Who's going to buy it? Our own people will buy it. When do our people get to read a book? Since all the week they're absorbed in earning their livelihood. They will get to read it on the Sabbath. When will they get to it on the Sabbath? Well, first they have to take the ritual bath. Remember, Hasidim go to the mikveh every Shabbat. Then they must learn and pray. Then comes the Sabbath meal. After the Sabbath meal, they finally have time to read. Suppose one of them stretches out on the sofa, takes the book and opens it. But he is full and he feels drowsy. And he falls asleep and the book slips to the floor. Now tell me, why should I have it? You know, so that has a certain uncomfortable ring of truth. And it reflects his disillusionment that many people have many more books on the shelf or on the floor than they have in the mind.
It's also a wonderful excuse for anybody who's ever wanted to write a book and hasn't gotten it out of the
mind. Well, the truth of the matter is that writing books is often more important for the author. if you have something that helps authors clarify their thoughts, even if no one reads it. That's certainly true with the bulk of legal writing that exists in the world. There are hundreds and hundreds of law reviews, and the articles are very, very long, unlike other disciplines where articles tend to be shorter. You know, in medical journals, for example, an article might be 3 or 5 pages. In law, everything has to be at least 100 pages. Usually going over the same thing has been gone over many times with, you know, the 2 pages of original thought that might be in there. So nobody, I mean, really, nobody reads them. Nobody reads them at all. But you have to write them anyway. You know, that's the way it is. Okay, look at the sacred goat, the next one. Rav Yitzchak Avorki, remember we talked about him, he was he's on the chart, he was another disciple of the Kutzker. He was one of the very few who were admitted to Rabbi Mendel during the period when he kept away from the world. Remember, that's after the last 15 years of his life. Once he visited Kutzk after a long absence, he knocked, he entered Rabbi Mendel's room and said in greeting, "Peace be with you, Rabbi." "Why do you say Rabbi to me? I am no Rabbi. Don't you recognize me? I'm the goats. I'm the sacred goats. Don't you remember the story? An old Jew once lost his snuff box made of horn." Remember in the old, they used to take, snuff, inhale snuff, and they would sneeze and clear the sinuses and the like. Mm-hmm. On his way to the house of study, he wailed, "Just as if the dreadful exile wasn't enough, this must happen to me. I lost my snuff box. Oh me, oh my, I've lost my snuff box made of horn." And he came.